Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am very happy to have as my guest Dora Malik. She has written an extraordinary book of poems. It's called Say So. It's a book about a relationship that includes violence and a certain amount of terror that begins in love and, like all relationships, becomes a fantasy about where relationships go when you lose your say-so, when you don't have permission to have your say-so. And in that way, it's a book full of revelations about the secret self, why you stay in love with someone who seems not to be saying, I love you anymore. And it's so strong and beautiful and bizarrely musical and extraordinarily graceful in its wordings. It seems as if the English language were a form of tongue twister or song lyric. I thought it would be a good idea to begin with a poem that is a love poem, demonstrably so, before things go sour. This is the poem by my guest, Dora Malik, when the relationship is still a smiling one.
Love poem. If by truth you mean hand, then yes, I hold to be self-evident and hold you in the highest. K.O. to my O.T. and bait to my switch, I crown you one-trick pony to my one-horse town. Dub you my one-stop shopping, my space heater, juke joint, tourist trap, my peep show, my meter reader, you best, batteries not included, bearing all or nothing. Let me begin by saying, if he hollers, end with goes the weasel, in between cream filling, get over it, meaning the moon. Tell me you'll dismember this night forever, you my punch drunken bag, tar to my feather, more than the sum of our private parts, we are some peekaboo, some peak and valley, some bright equation, if and then but, if then my fruit bat, my goo-gaw, you had me at no duh.
Love poem by Dora Malik. Now, even there, we're seeing him dismember this night forever, and he's her punch-drunken bag, tar to my feather. You know, the image there is of a lynching, not necessarily the equipment of an all-out, comfortable love poem. So from the very beginning, it seems as if some kind of fear or anxiety has been projected on to whatever is to come.
I think that's very true. And I think that in thinking and in feeling and in trying to connect with another person, for me, it's impossible to not come up against the truths of the human condition. What does it mean to be a human being? And I think one that's thrown into sharp relief when one is defining oneself in relation to another person. I think that the relationship that's at the heart of this book is also about a relationship with language. And to me, language, as I know it, is always enacting the kind of pleasures and betrayals that happen between people. So it's a relationship that's as much in the mouth and the heart and the mind as it is occurring in the sorts of places of this poem, the juke joint, the tourist trap, the lynching, the punch drunking, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, in only another two pages, there's a poem called Oh, Grow Up. And already we see things going bad because we seem to be seeing the inventions that people make when there's a wound on their face. How can you explain a blackened eye or some other kind of scar? And this poem is called Oh, Grow Up.
First things first aid and off track abetting. Next best bloodshot, blood work, smarmy reprimand commanding indoor voices, some chomping at the little bit small choice of soup or nut or thrum or hustle. Honey, clinch or canyon. Working girls include Wicked Witch of the Western Omelette, she of the one night, best for last stand. Last gal standing, fat lip and a canker, fat chance of better body work or better business as usual, smuggled tub of butter pecan. Yes, yes, hit you, and yes, so sorry, so long. Long way from Story County, sold for a song. Captain Obvious, you got a lip on you. Captain Obvious, we end each day on Earth.
So with each poem, as the book continues, we get a sense that these people, whoever they may be, are coming to live with the fact that they live on Earth, that one either comes back late and has been punched, maybe he's been unfaithful with a waitress, the Wicked Witch of the Western Omelette. You know, there's no knowing, but somehow they land on their feet or choose to. So to what extent is this a book about abuse? And is this a writer's fantasy or a life you are facing?
I would say it's a book about the way that people treat each other. And in that sense, it's not so much about autobiography or about an autobiography of violence, but it's a collective, if I may say so, it's a collective biography or autobiography of what it means to be human. I mean, the way that we treat each other, the way we manipulate each other, the way we at times come to some sense of the better parts of ourselves and our demons fly away. I think that in this time in history when information is everywhere, we have an information overload, I feel like I have the sensation that I'm looking in other people's windows constantly. And I find it difficult and maybe in some ways human to not be able to tell my window from other people's windows all the time. To me, that's a kind of empathy. And to me, that's why I write poetry, because one can take that stand that everyone shares these stories and everyone shares these truths and moments and images with each other.
I'm speaking to Dora Malik. Her book is Say So, a book of poems that explores the dark side of human relationships while expressing them in a language that's very arresting and charming, as if, well, this is what people do when they use language. They clean things up, while in fact our behaviors are often violent and express things that our words can't say.
I think that America and the world has a culture of pageantry and entertainment on top of violence and horror. The minstrel show, the sense that one is asked to dance in the face of injustice and violence and tragedy. And I think that's often how I come to poems, is I think, okay, I'll dance. And I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to moralize and say this is how people should treat each other. That's not my role. I used to have a friend who would say, when we got in political conversations, would say, well, if you were the president, what would you do? What would your policies be? And I would say, if I knew the answer to those questions, why would I be keeping them to myself? Why would I be sitting in my room? Why would I not be storming the Capitol building to make something happen that way? So I think that my poetry comes out of a deep sense of confusion and uncertainty, and I would hope that a reader could come to the page and share that with me, and together we could find the beauty in that, in the beauty that humans are not certain, and we are as much the product of our shared uncertainties as we are the product of our shared dogmas.
There's a poem here called Dancing with Strangers that expresses that. Since you mentioned the metaphor of dancing, but it becomes something a little less than Terpsichorean.
Dancing with Strangers. I'll do the worm, he said, then dropped to the floor where he writhed alone. I returned home and again glowing on the lawn, white fur, blue eyes, collarless thought of a dog. Shuffle and clatter as the men climbed up the embankment in the dark, born of trains, dropped to earth, grown and lonely, bearded, wielding bags of cans. Still bodies of junkfish carp, caught and discarded, that choked on air and expired reeking. And in the locked museum, all the statues hold their breasts.
We come to that last line with a kind of double take. There's, you know, our sense that it will be all the statues hold their breath, but it's all the statues hold their breasts. And that's a method in this book to give us a pun or something that deflects the eye from what we thought we would be hearing.
I think puns are embarrassing. I think they're shameful on some level. They're an urge that I feel I should not be proud of. And so in that sense, in the same way that one picks a scab, I return to them. They're a way of keeping my sense of where I'm going in a poem uncertain, on edge, not too confident, not too sure of itself. I'm always enacting, I think, in this book and in my poems in general, a kind of slippage, a kind of betrayal of where I thought I was going. And to go back to the idea of dancing, I mean, that happens all the time, that fall as part of the dance. So I think that's really important to me. And I don't think that all art has to be confessional or humiliating. I don't think all art has to be anything. But for me, I feel like revealing some part of myself or my consciousness that's not the slick, intellectual, certain face that I might hope that I would present, I think that's the closest I can come to telling a kind of truth.
As this book progresses, we get to the point where the speaker, she's chronically punning. She can't stop. She's in a state of almost double hysteria. She wants everything to be a joke, and yet everything is breaking her down. It gets to be the feeling that this poetry would very much like to be able to say something straightforwardly, but instead we have this. Is this your experience of the world, of the human condition?
Yes, definitely. There's a poem that actually didn't make it into this manuscript, but the first line of it was, uh-oh, holds ha-ha uncomfortably close. And I think to me, that's always how it is. I mean, I am a hysterical laugher. I am a person who laughs at the wrong time and at the wrong things and in the face of tragedy. And I don't always like that about myself. It's not a source of pride, and it's not a flippancy about the horrors of the world, about the things that people do to each other and do to the earth and do to other nations. but it is my reaction, and I feel like it would be a lie to not engage with language on the page in the same way that I find myself engaging with the world.
Now, you've been making implicitly a comparison between this couple at war and the nation at war and the slippage of language. Why do you take a couple, even a couple made of a combination of different people and situations you've known, and extend it to international behavior?
A couple for me becomes a microcosm of how people treat each other on a larger scale. I think we lose sight of the fact that nations at war, the way that communities treat other communities, start with individual people. There is no person that is a combination of people. There's no person that comes in a boxed set in a baker's dozen. So when you take your own individual consciousness and make the decision to commit that consciousness to another consciousness, I feel like that's the beginning of, you know, if you keep multiplying that and multiplying that, you have people treating each other on local, national levels. I mean, there's the sort of environmental saw now of think global, act local. And I think a lot in puns and in the kind of slippages that you're talking about. I also think a lot about the kind of prepackaged language that we use, advertising language and cliches and bromides. And so to me, I think that looking at how two people engage and fail to engage in language and in bodies may allow us to keep sight of the fact that, contrary to what the government would tell us, corporations are not people. Nations are not people, but they're made up of individual people. And I think that to keep those people from being anonymous and to keep them on the level of two people interacting, I think, to me, feels truer than trying to speak for nations.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Dora Malik, author, most recently, of Say So, a book of poems, which is published by the Cleveland State University Poetry Center. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dora Malik about her new book, Say So, a book in which the complexities of love are expressed through the duplicity of language, puns, ironies, idioms, and shifting contexts. I've been hearing so much about feminism re-entering poetry in different forms. People are talking now about a school of poetry called the Girlesque, and other ways of turning the female into an enactment of seduction, performing a role in order to escape the role. Do you feel any alignment or convergence with that kind of poetry?
I'm certainly interested in individual voices within those kinds of movements. But I think that, for me, poetry is a way to escape that kind of labeling of what you are and who you are. And so it's sort of back to the, I don't want to be part of any club that would have me. I think that poetry, for me, comes out of a contrarian impulse. And I think that if I felt I belonged too well in any group of people, I would start to get worried about that. Of course, that may be sour grapes on my part. Maybe I just haven't gotten the phone call in which I'm invited into the movement. So I think that I love anything that will get art back into people's heads and consciousnesses. So I think it's a good thing, and I don't want to say that these kinds of terms are purely marketing tools. I think there's a real sincerity behind them. But for me personally, I don't feel the need to coin the term that explains who I am. I mean, I would hope it would happen on the page without me having to do that kind of legwork.
Tell me, what about Sylvia Plath? Because there are sort of marked places where Plath gives a list of names, horror names and nicknames for Daddy. And there are poems here where that kind of list of the young woman's relation to an older man is articulated. Do you feel that Plath is part of your poetics?
I feel that Plath becomes a part, to some extent, of every young female writer's poetics. And so I do feel that she's present, but I feel like Elizabeth Bishop is also present for me, and Emily Dickinson is also present for me. And so I know who my mother is biologically, and I don't want to have to choose one mother in poetry. I'd like to be able to keep all of them. I mean, I think John Donne is my mother, and Shakespeare is my mother, and Stevens is my mother also. So I think I'm not writing for Sylvia Plath or writing for Emily Dickinson or two, but I feel like we're all very much in the same conversation, and I feel really honored to share a medium with these consciousnesses. I mean, I sometimes tell my students that poetry is the closest way I know to being able to time travel. When you read a poem, you are in that conversation with the consciousness that wrote the poem. And to me, that's amazingly thrilling.
Along the lines of the family of poets, I wanted you to read a poem called Self-Portrait with Family Tree. This is Dora Malik reading from her book, Say So.
Self-Portrait with Family Tree. They pull my puppet limbs to twitching, back to the horse thief and the rabbi's daughter, the pervert and the coroner, the witch killer, the judge. Panting from nipping the tip of my tail, I hang my pointed hat. They were the dogs, and they were the dog-eat dogs, and some of them died virgins, and some of them died trying, and some of them ate nothing and said they were stuffed, and some of them ate crow all night and woke with feathers between their molars and hollow bones beneath their beds. If this house caught fire, I'd grab my red boots and the chess set with the chewed-up queen. This morning I called my mother to tell her the one about the interrupting starfish, but couldn't finish, as the punchline was my open hand, palm, and all five fingers on her face.
I wanted to ask you about that ending. I see that the starfish is the hand that's on the mother's face, mouth, preventing her from speaking. So this joke can't be told over the phone because she can't reach over the phone to cover the mother's mouth. And also that with the hand open, there's something ironic about it having a punchline when you're bringing the hand to the face. Now, all these poems seem to deeply, emotionally return to a point of violence. This poem seems to be a poem in which, after the articulation of what men have been like, here is what women have suffered from them, and here is me wanting to call my mother and tell her that I've been punched, and not saying so in the call. The call is, in a sense, interrupted by the need to tell a joke instead. Where are we here?
We're on the phone, and I think that urge to tell a joke is It's a defense mechanism. It's a defense mechanism, and someone might say, well, get over it then. But who among us gets over it?
No one gets over it.
I mean, I think I read somewhere, and who knows, I mean, the science on these things changes all the time. But I remember reading somewhere that laughter, the urge towards laughter, that monkeys have a kind of laughter to signal an all clear sign, to say something dangerous was, you know, the leopard was coming by, but now it's gone and we're safe. And they make this noise like laughing. And so to me, this sense of ha-ha, let's laugh about it and willfully decide that we haven't been hurt, we haven't been wounded, we're still okay, is both kind of pathetic and also a kind of sustenance for me. And this punch, I mean, I was telling this stupid interrupting starfish joke. I was just telling this joke this morning to somebody's baby. You know, this baby that is pre-verbal but understands why it's both funny and horrifying to have a hand coming at your face.
Uh-huh. Now tell me, given the growing horror that this book faces, is poetry a representation of that horror, a consolation for that horror, the place one goes despite one's horror? What is it for you?
I would choose D, all of the above, definitely. I think that that's what makes it so exciting and confusing for me. I think when I figure out, I would be terrified if I could figure out what a poem was. Every time I sit down to write a poem, even a poem in a traditional form, it's like my mind goes completely blank. I have no idea what a poem is or why people choose to write it. It's such a bizarre thing to me. And it's back to that embarrassment. I think, what in the world? What a ridiculous thing to do, to write a poem, and yet here I am about to do it. In the same way that I think, what a ridiculous thing to trust somebody, and here I am about to do it. What a ridiculous thing to speak your mind, and here I am about to do it. So I think it's the truest place I know, and it's an artificial place.
I've been speaking with Dora Malik, author most recently of a book of poems, Say So, published by Cleveland State University Poetry Center. Thank you, Dora, for joining me.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.